I want especially to welcome our NPR audience. For those who are listening to a Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations presentation for the first time, let me introduce ourselves. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded 26 years ago by a small group living in the Midcoast area with an interest in the U.S. role in international relations. Membership is currently about 150 and includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign affairs. For further information, please see our website, www.midcoastforum.org. We have a monthly luncheon meeting, usually the first or second Monday of the month, year-round, to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. Today, we're happy to have Matthew Ho. Matt's a former State Department official who resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan last September. Prior to his assignment in Afghanistan, he served in Iraq, first in 2004 to 2005 in Salahuddin province with a State Department Reconstruction and Governance team. Then in 2006, he had been a reserve Marine. He went back to Anbar province as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations and issues at the Pentagon and State Department on and off during the years 2002 to 2008. His writings have appeared in the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, and his resignation letter has been cited as, quote, an essential document by the Council on Foreign Relations. He was recently named the 2010 Ridenour Prize recipient for truth-telling. So we're delighted to have Matt here. Come on up.
Thanks, Mac. It's very nice to be here today. I actually just came from Santa Barbara, California, so it's really quite a delight to go from that coast, where it's absolutely lovely, to here, where it's just tremendously beautiful. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come up here and speak to you all, and I want to thank Jim for reaching out to me a couple months ago and arranging this. Like I said, it's quite a pleasure to be here. My sister actually used to live in Camden. She lived in Camden for almost 20 years. So I've been up here quite a bit and think very fondly of this part of Maine and in Maine in general. However, I was saying to Mac last evening, the reason why I will always be fond of Maine is because in 2007, when I came home from Iraq my second time with my Marines and sailors, we were met at Bangor Airport by just a great crowd of well-wishers, and that hospitality and that homecoming that we received and that the folks of Maine do for every aircraft that returns from war with our soldiers and our sailors and our airmen and our Marines, and I don't know what percentage does, but the majority of aircraft do first land in Bangor as a first port of entry back into the United States. That homecoming that you showed us will be something that I'll remember for the rest of my life, and it's something that is still quite emotional when I think about it and I recall it. So I wanted to thank you all for what you do have done for us and what you've done for all those soldiers and sailors, airmen, Marines who returned home from war and received that homecoming. So thank you to all the people of Maine for that. I also want to I read an article recently, and just to make sure I give a plug for it, because I think it's one of the best pieces of journalism on Afghanistan that I've seen in the last few months, and it's the cover story that will be coming out in Newsweek this upcoming one on the Afghan National Police. And I just want to put that plug in there before I forget, because it really was such a great, great story. The disclaimer I want to give before I start talking, because a lot of times when I do speak, people are expecting me to say that the issue I have is with our military or with our State Department personnel, and I want to just first off state that that's not the case. No nation has ever had a better military, a more disciplined, more professional, more capable armed services than the United States currently enjoys. In the same vein, no nation, I believe, has ever had a better diplomatic corps, a more talented group of civilians working on its behalf than the United States currently enjoys. It's not a question about the capabilities of our men and women, both civilian and in uniform, but really a question of whether or not our involvement in Afghanistan is of benefit to the United States' interests, both in terms of security and in terms of prosperity. What is the value of our presence in Afghanistan for the costs, for the, it's almost, I think, roughly 80 Americans who've been killed there these last 2.5 months, and the hundreds of billions of dollars we'll spend this year, what benefit are we getting out of it? So it's not a question so much of whether or not can the U.S. forces go and seize that valley and take it from the enemy. Can we defeat the enemy in armed combat? Can we, our civilians, develop a community into something better than it was before? Of course we can, but is it worth it? What value do we here in the United States receive from having our young men and women fighting and dying and killing 8,000, 9,000 miles away from home? So what I'll do is I'll try and be brief in my comments because I find that often people have a lot of questions, and a discussion is not just beneficial to you all, but I also find a discussion very beneficial to myself. I'll also say that, too, when we get to the question and answer, if you'd like to talk about Iraq, I'm more than happy to talk about Iraq. I spent most of the last 8 years of my life working on Iraq. And also, too, I find people often want to talk about Iran, because Iran, of course, is dominates in the news right now. But people want to talk about Iran because they look in the sense of we've been doing Afghanistan and Iraq for the better part of the last decade. Iran is the next major challenge. Where do we go forward with that? How do we learn the lessons that have been applied, the hard-learned lessons that we got from Afghanistan and Iraq, and how do we apply them to Iran? How do we not make the same mistakes? How do we get something better over the last decade in terms of our relationship with Iran than what we got from our actions in Afghanistan and Iraq the last 10 years? So to begin with, there were four major points to my resignation from my post in Afghanistan. I should say that I was serving as a political officer with the State Department. I had been appointed to that position. It was a one-year post. I was basically a direct commission into the Foreign Service is probably best how to describe my position there. I was serving in Zabul province. I was the political advisor to a governor. This was pretty much everything I always wanted to be. You know, I was watching Lawrence of Arabia when I was 10 years old. I had been involved with counterinsurgency most of my adult career. Even when I was a platoon commander and a company executive officer in the Marine Corps, I was stationed in Japan. And we used to go and work with our counterparts in the Philippines and in Indonesia and in Thailand, all men that were involved in fighting active insurgencies in the southern parts or in the islands of their countries. So this is something that even before 2001, we were working on, because in our area of operations in Southeast Asia, there were active insurgencies that our allies were fighting. So to go and become, like I said, the political advisor to a governor whose province is completely controlled by the enemy and a counterinsurgency was ultimately a dream job for me. And it was the second best job I ever had in my life, the first being when I accompanied Command of Marines in Anbar province in 2006-2007. However, it got to a point, and my resignation is not just simply based off of my experience in Afghanistan, but relate back to my experiences in both Washington, D.C. and in Iraq since 2003. However, there are four points or four rational points that I came to in my service in Afghanistan, where I felt I could no longer participate in our operations there because I felt that the price we were paying, the lives of young Americans, was not worth the benefits that we were receiving. The first point in these four, and these are really in no particular order, but the first point was that our operations in Afghanistan, the presence of our combat troops, and the large amounts of money we're spending in Afghanistan have no effect on al-Qaeda. You know, most recently and most glaringly, the president
on December 1st said, I am going to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan in order to defeat and destabilize al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's response was, I'm going to put a bomb in some kid from Nigeria's underwear, route him through three different airports, and he's going to try and blow the plane up over Detroit. It just doesn't match up. How we're trying to attain the goal is not the way we're going about it. It's absurd. As I said, the presence of our forces in Afghanistan are having no effect on al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, after 2001, when we rightfully went into Afghanistan, we destroyed what was al-Qaeda central. We removed al-Qaeda from their base of operation in Afghanistan, and they fled worldwide. Predominantly, their leadership remained in Pakistan, but elements of them did go throughout the world. And they evolved, and they already were a loose organization, but now they really evolved into very loosely structured, not, if you're familiar with organization charts, not straight lines, but dotted lines between the different boxes. They have a leadership that's based in Pakistan, Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri, who we should capture. And I say capture rather than kill, because I'm a big believer that we need to treat them as criminals and as murderers, and not lionize them and treat them and call them warriors, because they don't deserve that. And so they should be captured and brought to justice, as opposed to killed and given some sense of honor on the battlefield, because they don't deserve that. But they exist in Pakistan, but they're really spiritual figureheads. They provide guidance. They provide intent. They don't actually command and control like we would in a normal organization. Al-Qaeda's operations are conducted worldwide by individuals or small cells that are often recruited from the area the attacks take place in. If you look at the evidence of the attacks for the last decade or so, including the attacks on 9/11, the bulk of the planning, the bulk of the training, the bulk of the operations, of course the operation, but all that occurs, all the preparation mainly occurs in the areas where the attack takes place. London, Madrid, Bali, most recently the things we've seen in the United States. And now we're seeing it really shift into where there may be almost no contact with the al-Qaeda organization based out of Pakistan. We don't think that Abdulmutallab, the Christmas Day bomber, had contact with people there. Major Hassan down in Fort Hood did not have contact with people there, and so on. So the presence of large formations of American troops do not have any effect on al-Qaeda. And I also do not believe that there is a link between al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Depending upon who you talk to, there was a relationship in before 2001. Some believe it was a firm relationship. Others believe it was just strictly a relationship of convenience, and that there are actually fissures between the two groups even then. But now they're two different groups. They have two sets of goals. Al-Qaeda is a worldwide group. The Taliban are a local group concerned with Afghanistan. The Taliban have made some assurances, or have come about making some assurances, that they won't harbor al-Qaeda again. And I think this is something that we need to exploit rather than push together. So the second reason is I found that what we were doing was taking part in a civil war that really had no effect or bearing on the United States or the West. If you go back to 2001, when the United States and the West went into Afghanistan, it was in the midst of civil war. And that's how the media constantly referred to it as. On one side, controlling Kabul and 90% of the country, was the Taliban, who represented the raw Pashtun people. On the other side was the Northern Alliance, which represented urban Pashtuns and other Pashtun groups, because they're, in addition to a civil war between ethnicities in Afghanistan and a civil war between the urban and the rural, there's also what you call civil war within the Pashtuns themselves. And it's very complicated, and it's not easy to dissect. It certainly isn't on tribal lines, because you'll see even Karzai is a Popalzai. Mullah Baradar, who we captured, or Pakistan captured back in February, the second in command of Taliban, is also a Popalzai. So it's a very, it doesn't break down neatly along tribal lines like we would like it to. It's very complex, but it's real. And then with the Northern Alliance, so you had urban Pashtuns and other Pashtun groups. You had And in the northern tribes, those who speak Dari in Afghanistan, the Tajiks, Uzbeks, Hazaras, Turkmens, other folks, the northern people. And that this is a war that really traces its roots in terms of the violence of it back into the 70s, into the mid-70s. You can trace it back to the overthrow of the king back in 1973. If you really want to, and if the academics can trace this back generations and hundreds of years. In fact, Afghanistan, the northern tribes were forcibly brought into the kingdom. They were subjugated into the kingdom. So this was a civil war that's been going on for quite a while. We intervened. We removed one side from power. We removed the Taliban from power. We put the Northern Alliance in power. But we did nothing to remedy or resolve the underlying causes of the conflict. We did nothing to bring about political stability in the country. We did nothing to bring about political order in the country. We just replaced one side with the other without bringing about any long-term solutions or lasting solutions to the problems that were causing the violence. And again, I could speak to this at length later, but you see certain things. I'm sure folks here in the room and folks who are listeners are familiar with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the leader of the Northern Alliance, who was viewed as the Lion of Panjshir. He was a very big Mujahideen figure in the Soviet-Afghan War. He was the leader of the Northern Alliance. And one of the most telling things for me when I was in Afghanistan, you would go to an Afghan army camp in southern Afghanistan, and in a province that's nearly completely Pashto, and rural Pashtun, so on the side of the Taliban in those wars, and on the place of honor on the wall of this army camp, an auditorium or wherever, and certainly on the brigade commander's desk, is a portrait of Ahmad Shah Massoud. I mean, so there is no better anecdotal example to me that this was the Army of the Northern Alliance that was now occupying southern Afghanistan. And you would see this. The province I was in, you had out of six Afghan infantry battalion commanders, we had four that spoke Dari, didn't speak Pashto at all. The brigade commander was a Tajik. You had this. The population there was 300,000, I said, desperately poor, subsistence farmers. These are the people that are living for less than a dollar a day. And the Afghan National Police were paying $180 a month. In the course of a year, we had one man join the Afghan National Police in that province, because the Afghan National Police did not represent those people. They were seen as an occupying force. They were seen not only as very brutal, very corrupt, as criminals themselves, they were seen as an occupying force. And this holds true also for the Afghan army, for the Afghan intelligence service, and then for the Afghan civil government. The civil government folks, the provincial government, the provincial ministers, the district governor, they are all appointed from Kabul. And for the vast majority of them are not from the areas, in the rural areas of the east and of East Afghanistan and southern Afghanistan. They are not from there. They are what we would call carpetbaggers. They really are. It would be the same as taking a guy like me, a guy from Jersey, and putting him in charge of a parish in Louisiana after Katrina. It had the same effect. I would be as welcome down there as they are welcome in southern and eastern Afghanistan. And when I say rural, I'm not talking about areas just outside of Kabul. I'm talking about those areas in the mountains and valleys of Afghanistan that are extremely poor, extremely isolated, and extremely traditional. And this has been a split in Afghan society between the urban and the secular the urban and the rural for decades. The third point is what I found was that, for the most part, and also too, I mentioned I was stationed in the south. I was also stationed in the east of Afghanistan near the Pakistan border as well. For the most part, where our troops were the most heavily engaged in eastern Afghanistan and southern Afghanistan, we were fighting people who were only fighting us because we were there. We were fighting people who were fighting us because of our presence, not because of a shared ideology to the Taliban, not because of a desire to bring about Sharia law in Afghanistan, to bring about an Islamic emirate in Afghanistan, but as a desire that they did not want to be occupied. After 8-9 years, they did not want a foreign presence, or for that matter, a central government presence that did not represent them in their valleys. Some of this came down to, astonishingly, what I found in, I'm sure people have heard, or the Korangal Valley, which our media has termed the Valley of Death. It really came down to a tax dispute. It really came down to an issue of whether or not the people of the Korangal could basically smuggle timber into Pakistan or not, and whether or not they had to pay taxes or revenue to the central government. And our troops are in the valley of death fighting and dying over what you really could break down into an internal tax dispute among the Afghans over whether or not local Korangalis, who in the year 2009 and 2010 now, speak their own language. When you get up into eastern Afghanistan, you have valleys where the people speak their own languages. That's how isolating they are. And these are valleys of 5,000, 10,000 people. These are not large communities. So we shouldn't be sending soldiers into there. We should be sending anthropologists into these places. So what you see is that it's just they want to be, and over time and time, as you go out and work with them, as you talk to the villagers, and one of, you know, certainly didn't have the experience where I sat at the embassy in Kabul and read PowerPoint slides all day, and that's how I got my information on Kabul. I was fortunate, or on Afghanistan. I was fortunate to have a position where my job was, and I was able to work daily with the Afghans, whether they be Afghan civil government officials or Afghan citizens. But the overlying trend in the conversations you had with the villagers was, leave us alone. And that was overwhelming. So basically seeing that our kids are fighting, dying, not against the Taliban, you know, as we tend to see the Taliban in the United States, i.e. Mullah Omar and the remnants of the regime from 2001. Certainly they don't have any ties to Al-Qaeda, these peoples in the valleys. The reason they're fighting us is because we're occupying them. And the fourth issue was, and this is more of an emotional one, and one of a sense of a moral one, of whether or not there is any purpose or any, not purpose, but any sense of honor in our kids, our young American men and women, fighting and dying to keep the Karzai regime in power. The stories you read about the corruption there are probably underplayed. I don't think you could over-exaggerate the level of corruption among the government in Afghanistan. This is not an issue that all Afghans are corrupt and it's their way of life. And no, it's not. This is a kleptocracy. This is, if you were to look it up in the dictionary, there would be the picture of Karzai and his ilk next to the definition of kleptocracy. This is a government that is for itself, in its purposes and its ways. And the fact that our kids are fighting and dying to keep in power is wrong. And we saw that with the stolen elections in Afghanistan. I could tell you, I worked on the elections. I was involved in the elections in Zabul, and they were stolen at the cost of $250 million American dollars to do the elections. And by the way, I figured it close to 100 American dead over the summer, because remember last spring we were rushing American soldiers and Marines to Afghanistan to ensure democracy was going to take place. And so we had kids fight and die this summer for an election that was stolen. And then to have our government turn around and say, well, that's okay because it's really not about that anymore, that's wrong. In 5, 10, 15 years from now, we will have no honor in this. Most recently, in the battle for Marja and the assault on Marja, I can't remember off the top of my head how many American Marines were killed during that, but it was between 10 and 15. The man we put in power in Marja was a man who had lived in Germany for the last 15 years, who had spent 4 years in prison for attempted murder in Germany. So we put this carpetbagger, this ex-con in power, and how many American Marines died to do that? For what purpose? So, you know, so this last point is more of an emotional one or a moral one for me. There's nothing, this does not make sense for us as a nation to be doing. This is not right. Our American military, our young men, you know, you get among the infantry, both the Marines and the soldiers, and there's no better class of individual in the world than an American infantryman. And they will do anything we ask of them. They're professional warriors. They will do anything we ask of them, and they'll do it disciplined and professionally and with honor and with courage. And they are in both Iraq and Afghanistan, they are truly the greatest example of American citizenry. They don't steal from the locals. Might does not make right. They are wonderful examples of American virtue overseas in the way they conduct themselves in the midst of combat, no less. And they will do anything we ask of them. And that's why we have an obligation. The American people, and then by extension our leadership in Washington, D.C., has an obligation to only commit them to combat and commit them and put them in harm's way when it's of absolute benefit to the security of the United States or to the prosperity of the United States. And that's just not evident to me in Afghanistan. So one of the problems when you talk about this, when you talk about Afghanistan, is you tend to get put in two camps of either you're all in or you're all out. And, of course, that's nonsense. And anyone who's all in is an idiot, and anyone who's all out is equally idiotic. Because it's just like anything else in life. It's not that clear. It's not that black and white. And, yes, for terms of broader regional reasons, we want a stable Afghanistan. And what the goal should be is there is getting political stability. I'm a big believer, after seeing what I've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, studying it on my own, that without political stability, without political order, you can never have security, and then you can never have development. And that you need to start with political stability first. And so right now what you have in Afghanistan is you have a government. There was an ABC News poll back in January that said 68% of Afghans support the American presence in Afghanistan. And I'm not a big believer in polling done in war zones or polling done in countries where they've had repressive governments for decades. But this one, actually, I believe the numbers are right. I would actually turn that around, and I would say the American presence supports 68% of Afghans. The problem is that there's 32% of Afghans who are outside of that support, who are violently opposed to our presence because they're not reaping any benefit from them. They're not reaping any benefit from the American riflemen on the ground there, and they're seeing the other side of Afghanistan receiving the benefits, particularly the billions of dollars we spend there in aid. And that's why I mentioned that Newsweek article earlier. It talks about the Afghan National Police that I encourage you all to read. The U.S. and the West have spent between $40 and $60 billion in development money in Afghanistan since 2001. And most experts will say, and most people will say, it's just not visible. I mean, where has it gone to? And it certainly has gone to people we're supporting and lining their pockets. So we need to find something to bring those other 30. Oh, one interesting thing about that Newsweek poll and how I talk about how, and I couldn't have made this up. This was for my purposes and my argument. It was wonderful. I talked about there's a split between the rural Pashtuns and the Dari-speaking part of Afghanistan, that there's a civil war. If you look at that poll and you go through the data, and any polling done in Afghanistan, you need to really break into it because, you know, you go on that poll and you'll find that 91% of recipients in eastern Afghanistan said the Taliban should be part of the government of Afghanistan. I mean, this is a very regionalized country. You need to break it down and drill down to the numbers. But you'll see that, so 68% support American presence and 32% opposed. While the numbers for respondents who answered that poll, numbers that spoke Dari, who answered the poll, 68%. The numbers that spoke Pashto, 32%. I mean, I couldn't have made it up. In terms of showing, just in terms of polling data, which again I usually don't agree with for a war zone or for Afghanistan, but this it makes my point. So, like I said, we need to find political order. The first thing I recommend is. Negotiated ceasefire and withdrawal of U.S. presence from these valleys where we're fighting people who are only fighting us because we're there. This actually, I believe, would undermine the political strength of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Because right in Taliban, i.e. the folks who are in sanctuary in Pakistan, the remnants of that regime from 2001, not these local groups that are fighting us that we just call Taliban because we're lazy in our semantics. That would actually undermine their strength, because right now what binds all these local groups together and what has them support the Taliban, the Taliban Central, if you want to call them, is our presence. So all of a sudden we start pulling out of their valleys. There's no choice any longer. They don't have to choose between the Taliban and us. You take that away from them, and the Taliban start to lose popular political support throughout southern and eastern Afghanistan. And you see that because we talk about the momentum of the Taliban these last 4 or 5 years, and that the Taliban are building momentum. Well, you know what? They've been building momentum since 2006, because since 2006, we have continually increased our troop presence throughout southern and eastern Afghanistan. We've been pushing the people to the Taliban because we're showing up and our presence. And you'll see that. We'll send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, and we'll find more people who will be in violent disagreement to our presence, who will then become, i.e., Taliban. So in ceasefire, too, I mean, the residents of Marja, they were not about to line up on the road and march and take Kabul. If we left them alone, they were going to leave us alone, and that's how so many of those places are. The next point would be negotiations, and we see hints of that. There's an article today in the Washington Post. Karzai's proposing a peace conference for April or May, and there's a great push for negotiations, really on all parts. The UK Foreign Secretary just came out for it. Across the board is a bigger push for negotiations, except for really our government. We have had some statements, but not as much as we should or as much would be in our interest. And basically the idea being that there's a couple aspects behind having negotiations. One, they're all tired. The Taliban are tired. Karzai's side is tired. They've been fighting for 35 years. They also believe that the United States is leaving, and I believe we're leaving too. I believe the president is going to begin withdrawal in 2011. And they know that. And so I think all parties, including the Pakistanis, see that happening. And they want to have negotiations now, while there's this way it gets everybody the best deal possible. Because if you can have negotiations before the Americans leave, there's a better chance of the settlement sticking. If you don't have negotiations until after the Americans leave, well, then you're fighting for seats at the table at that point, I think. So I think most parties see the best deal possible occurring while the United States' presence is still there. I know that's a little counterintuitive, but that's how I tend to see that working. And the final point of this would be a reformation of the Afghan government. The Afghan government is a heavily centralized form of government. It is heavy on delivery services, and it's heavy on, which requires then a heavy rate of taxation. Afghanistan's always been they've had centralized government before, but it's always weak. The king reigned by not reigning. He didn't tax, and he also didn't deliver services. He let people self-govern. So what you've got to get back to is a form of government in Afghanistan that's self-governing. It also needs to be a sustainable form of government. Right now, when Karzai said a few months ago that he expects the Americans to support him for 20, 25 years, he's not kidding. There is no sustainable economy in Afghanistan besides the poppies. The only other thing they have right now where they could generate some form of revenue is their customs revenue. And that's so horribly corrupt, and the political order is so fractured that you won't see any of that customs revenue really going into Kabul without the makings of a better political order within the country. You need to, as I said, self-governance. That means having a more regional form of government, broken out along geographical areas and ethnic lines. So I think traditional capitals like Herat and Mazar Sharif and Jalalabad and Kandahar would be these regional hubs. You also need to reset it back to 1973. I mentioned earlier you have these Afghan security forces that are dominated by non-rural Pashtuns in the rural Pashtun areas. You need to stop that. You need to get the Tajiks and Uzbeks and Hazaras back to their parts of the country. Okay, you need to have this sense of occupation that they're feeling in the south and the east removed. And then so you work out, so you have a very small government with very limited goals that's sustainable. And that's how you go forward in Afghanistan. And then at that point, and you're probably going to require peacekeepers, and some other things. But at that point, you have political order. And at that point, you can have security. And at that point, you can have development. Now, I saw that was the case in Iraq. I was part of the surge in Anbar province. When I got to Anbar, it was a complete mess. We had upwards of 60 attacks in my regiment's area of operations a day. When we left, we were down to 7 a day. We were having one Marine killed every day we were there. Every time you left, every time you went to the cities, you got in a firefight. By the time you left, it was eerily quiet, spookily quiet, to the point when we were concerned more about just basic vehicle and weapon safety than attacks by the enemy on us. And don't let people fool you that it was a surge that did that. It's part of it. But it was because we brought into the political process, into the power, the people who had the power at the local levels, the traditional local power brokers. That's what we did. It was our bringing into power the local Anbar sheikhs, allowing the Anbar awakening to be successful, and then bringing into security the Sons of Iraq so that they can control their areas. That's why we still don't have 34,000 American Marines in Anbar Province. If we had just gone with what we were doing, which was successful, and it's the proudest achievement of my life, the combat operations we did in 2006 and 2007, we would still be there. We'd still be garrisoning it. We need to so just like in Iraq, what we did, and Iraq certainly isn't a success story in this year, and I know you've got Tom Ricks coming in a couple months, and I know he said it. He feels that Iraq for 2010 will be as important for Iraq as 2003 was, and I agree. Iraq is not a success story yet, and it could go either direction. But for Afghanistan, if we want to get to the point where we can start talking about the possibility of success, we have to bring about an established political order that respects the traditional power brokers within the country and respects and understands the ethnic and cultural differences within the country. So with that, I'll take your questions. And again, it's been a real pleasure to be here.
Hey, Matt, that was terrific. We just had, as I told you last night, we had a Camden conference about a month ago that was on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, but ended up talking about primarily Afghanistan. And I have to say that what we heard from you in the last 30 minutes was a terrific summary of what we'd gotten from a great Camden conference over 2 days. I mean, this was really terrific. Questions? We'll start here. Yeah. Microphone.
Well, thanks. Thank you very much for being here. And first, I want to thank you for your courage in speaking truth to power and coming here to share why you spoke the way you did and wrote the way you did in changing your mind about what you were, where you should be. And I am an anthropologist, but I'm not speaking in order to volunteer to go to those eastern valleys. My memory of, comes in terms of an anthropological experience in Indonesia in the 60s and the 70s when I was working with Indonesians who, of all things, were resistant, as you've described your Afghani experiences, resistant to the great powers being occupiers. They'd had that experience with the Japanese during World War II. They'd had it under the Dutch, of course, for centuries. And then they were leery of the Russians, of the Americans, of the Chinese, and anybody else who might come in to be a great power and be an occupier. So I learned then something that I think is germane to your experience of what I want you to think about is how do you get from the 50s or 60s in Indonesia to current Indonesia where a parliamentary government of some democratic structure is in place to that in Afghanistan without more civil war? Because over and over, the rationale we hear is that if we don't support a central government, civil war will be worse. So I'd be interested in your thoughts about how you get the ethnic and the diverse people actually beginning to work together.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing you said there was that you started off in the 50s or 60s, and now it's 2010. So I think the key point is time, and we're not going to do it just by showing up and spending a lot of money and giving them the internet and cell phones and expecting them to come into, the modern era or what we term the modern era. I think one of it has to be a process on their own. It has to be a process that they develop on their own. And what they end up for their government in, it's 2010, so 2060, 2070, should be on their own processes, not on what we see in terms of our liberal Western democracy. And that might work for them, but it might not. And we have to understand that and respect that. And but the key is to bring about, like I said, political order, and to get the raw Pashtuns who are outside of the political order right now, get them back into it. And that means you're going to have to let the Taliban have power in the south and east of the country. You're just going to have to have it. And I think I think that Karzai and the other members of his government, including the former warlords of the Northern Alliance, are fine with that. And I think they will be fine with that because they see that as getting Afghanistan to a point of stability. And I think particularly if they can share it in the resources, and i.e. resources being international development money that will have to go into Afghanistan for a long, long time. But the key thing is in those southern and eastern parts of Afghanistan, getting the people who were removed, who were traditionally in power there, getting them back into power. And that's the first step. And then from them, it has to be a process on their own. And they may not. They may not choose to have a government that looks like a European one or an American one. But like I said, the key point is what you're talking about was a process that took 60, 70 years where, particularly Indonesia, they had a brutal dictatorship. They had terrible, terrible bouts of fighting there. I think we just have to be mindful of that and not have some Pollyannish, idealistic vision for Afghanistan that supports our American narrative, basically.
I find your discussion totally interesting, and my question may be totally out of order. If from what I read, the country's main means of support is its sale of drugs to the rest of the world, what would it cost the United States to no longer become a customer of theirs?
No, that's a great question. And actually, I think on the order of how much of that opium makes it to the United States, it's less than 10%. My understanding is that almost 90% of that opium goes to Europe and to Russia. It's not America's problem. And where I find very specious is the argument we need to be there because of the drug problem when we have such a calamity and a catastrophe in Mexico right now. The murders that just, it's unbelievable how many people are being murdered every year in Mexico and how destabilizing that is to our southern border. So the argument is that we need to be in Afghanistan because of the drug problem I find just incredibly specious. And, I had a good friend of mine killed back in October. He was a DEA agent, was killed in Afghanistan. We've been in the Marine Corps together, I've been in Iraq together. Great guy. And, United States lost a wonderful man, a guy, he was my age, he should have been a leader in this country, he should have been a congressman 20 years from now, and he died in Afghanistan fighting a drug problem that's not ours, so.
I've heard figures of a ratio of U.S. contractors to troops over there is about 3-2, if that's true. What's the impact other than just feeding the corruption?
The use of America of contractors, and most of the contractors are local, and most are Afghans, and most of them are doing work that we don't need American soldiers to do. So they're doing cooking and cleaning and that kind of stuff. But it's a heavy contractor presence. I believe the estimate is for the 30,000 additional troops that are going to Afghanistan from the U.S. they will need 50,000 contractors to support them, which is a huge boon. And so if anyone thinks that the decision not to send more troops didn't have a lot of money lobbied behind it in Washington, D.C., from the consulting firms, the think tanks, and the different development organizations, as well as the contracting firms, you've got your head in the sand. There's so much money off of this. And I'm not saying that's what the president did it, but that's a real aspect of it. But the amount of money being spent there, this is going to sound crass, okay, but it's the best example I can give. Because there's no political order in Afghanistan and the amount of money we're pumping into it, it just makes the situation worse. It's the same as if you take a bunch of dogs, throw them in the room, don't let them socialize, don't let them establish their feeding order yet, and then throw red meat in there and see what happens. That's what we're doing. The country is awash. I had Afghans in both parts of the country who didn't know each other say to me, we call this the golden era because this is the time to get the gold. And that's one of my things is one of my recommendations would be stop the development money. With the exception of non-emergency, not so money that aid that's not going to just keep people alive from starving to death, stop it because it's making the problem worse. You're just greasing the corruption there. The reason why they're able to spend so much money on corruption, the reason why, yeah, I think it was estimated almost $3 billion was spent in bribes last year by Afghans, was because we put that much money in the country. You take that money away, and now you've got a chance possibly for a political process to somewhat work. Otherwise, it's not. If you're in power, it's not worth it to you to give it up because the money is so good.
Can you compare and contrast the approach of the Americans in Afghanistan with the approach of our allies in NATO? What are the European countries doing that's different? And how do you see whatever differences you identify, how do you see those playing out in the future? Do they learn from us or do we learn from them?
And I have to say, from my perspective, I was in eastern Afghanistan and southern Afghanistan. In the east, there was only an American presence, and that was heavy on the carrot and stick. I could tell you the four provinces I was in, I was with 3rd Brigade, 1st Infantry Division, in the four provinces we were in the east there on the Pakistan border, about 4.5 million people. The brigade over the course of the year dropped 500,000 tons of ordnance over aircraft, shot about 50,000 rounds of artillery and mortar fire, and on the other hand, spent over $160 million in a year, just the military did, in development work, roads, bridges, schools, those kinds of things. And their troops were engaged every day in firefights. So that's where that had gotten us to there. In the South, which was in Regional Command South, was a NATO operation down there. And there are problems with that because all the different nations have caveats and they all have to report back to their headquarters. And the same thing with the International Security Assistance Force headquarters in Kabul. It's multinational. And so we used to joke it's like going to Epcot Center. I mean, it's just there's 25 different kinds of uniforms up there. So can you imagine being General McChrystal or General McKiernan, or General Eikenberry or whoever, and having to make a decision, and your staff is composed of all these different nationalities who have to get permission or buy-in from their capital before they can agree to what you want to do. How, in terms of like running a functional organization, this should be a case study for business students on how not to do it. But in the South, in the South they do the same things too. They spend a lot of money. The Canadians spend a lot of money, and they shoot a lot of bullets. The Brits and Hellman spend a lot of money and shoot a lot of bullets. In the North, which is also NATO, and that's primarily the European nations, Germany and Norway and the Swedes, and they don't shoot a lot of bullets, and they spend an okay amount of money. But where they're at, those people there are the people who are in power, are the people that NATO is backing. In southern and eastern Afghanistan, we're spending all this money and shooting all these bullets to no avail. 2010 is the worst it's been so far. And in 2011 will be the same. It's because we're occupying people. It's because we're occupying people who are not part of the political process in Afghanistan. So regardless of what approach you take, if we took an approach like the Germans take, say, and we spend a little amount of money, we don't patrol at night, we don't engage in offensive combat operations, they would just probably leave us alone. Take what money we offered them, but leave us alone because we weren't bothering them. And it would have no effect, basically. And they would still be at war with the central government. So I don't see the approach is really mattering. I see it being having understanding of what the underlying political problem is.
Hi. Thanks, Matt, for a very good presentation and for the witness you have given to clear analysis about what's going on in Afghanistan. I want to ask a question that may be not easy for you to give an answer, but from your own experience. Clearly, you came to these views and an analysis about what works and what doesn't work, and at a certain point felt you simply had to resign. You were offered, and justifiably so, positions by the ambassador in Iraq, by Dick Holbrooke back in the States and so on. There was some understanding that your view was of value to them in the end, you felt the overall system wasn't one you could continue with. Do people simply not get it in the higher levels up to the top policy levels? Do they get it, but there are political considerations? How do you gauge the decisions the Obama administration has made that aren't as different from the previous administration as some of us clearly hoped and are still headed down essentially a dead-end trail?
It is. Thanks. That's a great question. It's a question I've had asked a lot. I've been asked a lot, and it's difficult to answer, and it probably is. There's no one answer. It's a combination of it all. There are people who simply don't get it, who just don't get it. And that's kind of probably in the minority. And those are the folks that are the ones I've encountered in the military and at state and in the intelligence community. They're the ones who go to Kabul, spend their entire deployment at Kabul, never leave the embassy grounds, know everything about Afghanistan based off of the PowerPoint briefings they receive. But they are committed to our strategy. They're committed to, you know, the narrative that we have. And so that's what they believe. And I experienced that both in Afghanistan and particularly in Washington, D.C. There's political issues. For reasons, whether it's for personal career reasons or for larger political ones, I'm a big believer that, and I can tell you, and I won't break confidences with who's told me this, but a lot of people within government, military and state, in Afghanistan, as well as in the administration here, agree with what I'm doing and agree with what I'm saying. And maybe when it's all done, I'll say who they are. So I believe, though, I'm a believer that one of the reasons why the military so fervently and also I shouldn't say the military, but also there's folks to state and in the administration, other places that want to see a military victory or the sense that we send more troops to Afghanistan, we defeat the Taliban on the battleground, that brings about negotiations, we're able to go home, like what we had, say, in Iraq, is because they don't want to see the U.S. military suffer what would be perceived as a defeat. That they don't want to see the U.S. military being seen as running out of Afghanistan, as being part of a cut and run, and this differentiates us from the Soviets. I believe that just like you had with Rumsfeld and with the neoconservatives for the good part of last decade, they wanted to put their print on American foreign policy and on American military operations and be damned with the reality of things, like human nature. You have that within American military and civilian leadership now, that because we are offering people good governance, because we are offering them a better way of life, because we are offering them a chance to be part in an elective democracy, that they will forget and remove themselves from generations of ethnic violence and separatism. I think we have that. We have people who want to put their mark on American military history as well. So there's a lot of things, but it's difficult. I mean, I got this question from folks on the Hill. Why is McChrystal saying this? And I got you and the kids in my graduate class who just came back, my graduate studies class who just came back from there saying the same thing. I can't tell you. I mean, some of it's the way we do business, some of it's political concerns, some of it's just no one wants to tell the boss he's wrong. I mean, just based on organizational management issues. I'm sure the CEO of Coke has his moments when this happens. You know, don't tell the boss that Pepsi's new product is beating us in the Southwest, you know? Let him think we're still outselling Pepsi Light or whatever, you know? So I don't know. I mean, I think it's an organizational problem that all large organizations, I'm sure Caesar didn't get told that what was going on, you know, on a German front. I'm sure there are times he was told all was going swimmingly on the German front. The barbarians were not a threat to Rome. I don't know.
I wonder if you could elaborate on your answer concerning drugs, given that we apparently are not consuming this particular supply of heroin, but within the country, from your experience on the ground, you've laid out some viable possible futures. How would the drug aspect of that play out optimally? What are the possibilities?
Optimally, it takes 20 to 30 years. You have political order in place. It ends the political violence, ends the civil war. So you got security, then you have development. So now you start building roads, you start building electricity support, cold storage facilities. You start having international delegations come up, as well as an Afghan government that can function and that can send people abroad to open up markets for their products. And then you have an agricultural-based system that's able to export. Right now, none of that's there. The thing with the opium trade, it's the only industry in Afghanistan. It's the only thing that has a value chain that starts from you can get credit to buy fertilizer all the way up to there's a ready and available market for it. There's nothing else like that. I mean, there's nothing else. And it's going to take decades to get that, and you need to have a stable country to do that. So it's just going to take a long time, a long time to have some other option besides the drugs. And the way we're going right now, it's just not the showcase example is Nangarhar province in the east, and Governor Gul Sherzai, who, if anyone's read Sarah Chay's book, The Punishment of Virtue, which is a book I strongly recommend, he is originally from the south. He gets put as governor up in Nangarhar, which was one of the larger poppy-producing provinces. He eliminates it. So what do? We give him $10 million, which he keeps for himself. Not only that, the backstory of this is Sherzai's family owns poppy fields in Kandahar. So what was he doing up in the east? Eliminating his competition. But that's an aspect that we don't talk about. You know, we just talk about how this guy, this governor who's on our side, who we paid, basically he got the award of $10 million for doing this. And if you talk to, there's a great guy out there, I had the privilege of being on a panel with him a couple months ago, a guy named David Mansfield, who quit from the United Nations after serving for several years, and probably the smartest guy I know on drugs and opium. He'll tell you most of the numbers are fudged. I mean, he's got photos of, like, here's what we documented being eradicated, it doesn't exist, and it's an enormous, enormous field. So just like anything else, the numbers kind of get funny at times.
This morning I read in the paper that the election in Iraq has turned badly for the existing powers, that al-Maliki is now looking for a recount, that the Kurds are looking for a recount in Kirkuk. What do you think is going to happen now that the election is turning out differently than the powers that be had expected?
That's a great question. I think most people, whichever way the election turned out, most people would be guessing. It's what I think in terms of American interests that are occurring is that you'll have blocks that will align within Iraq. So I think what you'll see is a group of Sunni nationalists, Shia secularists, and the Kurds aligning to form a bulwark against the Shia groups that we see as aligned with Iran. Whether or not they actually are, I tend to agree that they are, but that you see that this kind of like two parts of Iraq form against one another. I think what we have to do is we still have a heavy diplomatic and military presence in Iraq, and when I'm not saying we keep our troops. There are troops to proceed out as they are scheduled, and they should be out of there by, you know, although I don't think they ever will be fully out of there, but our combat troops should be out by the end of August like we're planning to do, because their presence is not welcome and not wanted in the way that we envision it. What I think is going to happen with our troops, actually, is I think we'll probably renegotiate the agreement, and we'll end up keeping troops there kind of open-ended between 10 and 20,000 troops for the next however many years, like I said, open-ended, in order to give backing to those groups that feel like they would be encroached upon by Shia groups that are allied with Iran. So for our purposes, I see us being in Iraq for quite a long while, serving our troops based at air bases, not leaving the air bases, not conducting operations, but serving as a presence to form this bulwark against Iranian encroachment into Iraq as these Iraqi groups, the Kurds, the Sunnis, and secular Shias see. But in terms of what's going to happen this next year, I mean, I hope that what we've given them in terms of a political process works. And I'm afraid that we'll have groups there that will try and put that country back into a nasty state of sectarian war and conflict and civil war like we saw, you know, a few years ago. you know, primarily Al-Qaeda in Iraq will resurge and will continue to do their truck bombings and everything else. But the important thing is to make sure none of the major players in that country feel disenfranchised again or feel removed or outside of power. If that occurs, then you'll definitely see the violence flare again. For example, if the Sunnis feel like they're threatened, if the Ambaris feel like they're going to be left out of particularly the revenue of the country, then you'll start to see many more truck bombs going off in Baghdad. But hopefully that doesn't occur and the political process holds.
Last question.
This is a much less serious question.
Okay.
What do you think of Bush Qazi as a means for the Pashtu tribes for settling tribal disputes? And doesn't apply to the Northern Alliance as much, but that has been a traditional way of settling disputes.
Sure. What she's describing is the traditional Afghan game of Bush Qazi, where it's like polo, but with a headless goat. I'm sorry? A predecessor polo. I need to brush up on my equestrian sport history. You know, they don't. It's not played that much in the South and the East. If it's played at all, I wasn't aware of them playing it. It seems to be more of a northern sport, but certainly that would be a better way than them fighting, shooting each other. Although you get hurt. From my understanding, you play that game, you get really hurt. It's very rough. It's actually, if you go online, if you go to YouTube or something, Bushkazai, roughly that. Look that up, and you'll find video of these guys playing. And it's very rough, and it's very dramatic. Your point is valid. How do we help the Afghans? How do we help the Afghans find a solution to their political differences without the barrel of a rifle? And the one thing, after all this talking, I hope I've made clear is that I see a stable, or I probably haven't, but I see a stable Afghanistan being important for the United States because of Iran, Pakistan, India, and regional stability. But I don't see us as having to achieve that by losing 30 to 40 good young Americans a month and spending $100 billion a year. I don't see that as necessary to do that, or the benefits being that great that we have to do that. I appreciate all your time, and I want to thank you again for having me up there. And again, thank the people of Maine for supporting our kids when they come home from war, like they do at Bangor, or Bangor, right? Sorry. But all right, thank you.
All right, wait, hold your applause. Hold your applause for the presentation, which Matt is unaware of. This is, unless he's been told in advance, which may have been the very reason he agreed to come to this talk. The famous Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations mug.
Oh, thank you very much. Hey, thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
Great. I actually get very little swag where I go, so it's terrific.
No, that was great.
Okay, thanks.